Josh Richards is an Australian comedian who's going to Mars. And when he gets there, he's going to live the rest of his life there. At least that's what he hopes will happen. Josh Richards is an official astronaut candidate with the Dutch-based Mars One project. Mars One is a privately backed consortium which plans to populate Mars with humans. Josh was chosen from a field of 200,000 initial applicants, and he's now one of the remaining Mars 100. I should also say that Josh has a background in applied physics and psychology. He's worked as a combat engineer with the Australian and British Armed Forces. Comedy is a relatively recent thing for him, but he loves doing it, and he's just finished a show at the Adelaide Fringe this year called Cosmic Nomad, and he's performing it all around Australia and the world. Anyway, by the end of 2016, the Mars 100 will be whittled down to a gang of four, two men and two women, who will then begin a decade's training. They'll need to learn all the necessary skills to start a new colony that will produce its own oxygen, water and food. The thing that makes this mission different from, say, the Apollo moon landings is that the astronauts won't be coming back. They're participating in the full knowledge that the mission is one way, and there will be no possibility of returning to Earth. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Richard. Sounds a bit grim.
Yes. Well, well, grim but exciting and thrilling and sort of sane and insane all at the same time.
I like to call it the right kind of crazy. That's what I'm running with.
You've got to put that on your poster,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, definitely.
And let's just be clear here. This is not a joke. I know you're a comedian, but this is dead serious.
This actually stems out of me wanting to write a comedy show a couple of years back now. I'd written a comedy show about the end of the world, and I wanted to leave it on a slightly hopeful note. And the hopeful note was that maybe if we had a massive event that was going to wipe humans off this planet, it would be the reason to go and explore another one. And it's real.
And again, just to be clear, I just clear the air, this is not a publicity stunt. You will go through with this if you are selected.
I was writing a show angry that we hadn't done it. So it's not a publicity stunt. I've given up doing regular stand-ups so that I can train and become a national candidate to sort of go to space. That's what this is all about.
I have a vague recollection of President George W. Bush, saying sometime in the early 2000s, yes, a manned mission to Mars. Well, that didn't happen. What does making it a one-way mission make possible?
Originally, Bush's plan was to send people back to the moon, and that's something NASA's been pushing for a really long time. When Obama was elected, he's been pushing for Mars ever since. And so with the incoming new US president, we might see a change of policy again. The big appeal with going one way, I suppose, is that we left low Earth orbit in 1972. That was the last time that humans went beyond low Earth orbit. And we've never explored since because we went to the moon and we didn't stay there. We came back.
So why isn't it a return mission that's being planned? Why one way then?
There's a couple of factors with it. One is that kind of having that permanent human presence. So we've got people living in Antarctica, doing research, things like that. Having that permanent sort of presence means that people exist there and it's something that people can aim for. The other factor with it is, in terms of actually getting human beings back to Earth, there's some real technological and physiological challenges. We can't land a rocket on the surface of Mars that's big enough to get people back to Earth. The smallest one that NASA's designed so far weighs about 40 ton, and the biggest thing we've ever landed on Mars is the Curiosity rover at 1 ton. So we can't land rockets that are big enough to come back. The other problem is the longer we spend in space, the more our bones break down. So we might design a rocket that gets us all the way back to Earth. We might get the entire distance all the way back to Earth and then die in the last few minutes as we're experiencing 8-9 Gs of force coming back through the Earth's atmosphere.
Oh, my God. You mean like people could just break up like
would
a pavlova?
Literally just, turn into a bit of a puddle person. So pour you out of the spacecraft afterwards.
Tell me a bit about Mars One, the consortium behind this project. This is a private consortium.
Mars One's a private, not-for-profit organisation based in the Netherlands. They are their own entity. They're not affiliated with any government. And they're deliberately not accepting funds from any government.
It's all about... Why is this?
Well, the issue that we've seen with a lot of space exploration is that you have a change of government, and so they have a change of plan. You saw it between Bush and Obama. You're probably going to see it with Obama and whoever takes over from there. So space programs like this need more than a 4-year term. They need longer sort of perspectives in order to do these things. And so by making it independent, you can get companies to invest in something that's going to take 10, 15 years.
Also, you know, honestly, the idea of a one-way mission to Mars is, you know, ethically controversial.
Yeah.
And you won't see a government able to do that.
Strangely enough, I've just been here in Adelaide working with John Connolly, who's about to take over NASA's human Mars mission planning. And John and I talked about all of this. And he said there's no way a government agency could ever send people on a one-way mission because they have to have their astronauts back for PR value. They need them back on Earth to talk about space exploration and inspire people back here on this planet. They could never send them and leave them there somewhere else.
Well, that's true. But also governments would have a real problem ethically, I think, sending people knowing they're not going to come back. In a sense, though, I suppose don't want to over-romanticize this, but you are kind of like the old mariners of centuries ago in the age of exploration. I suppose they'd get on a boat and wouldn't know if they'd ever come home.
Yeah, and a lot of people draw different parallels from whatever cultural background they come from. So some people use the maritime example. Other people talk about the sort of the frontiersman exploring the US West or up into the high country in Canada or people coming and colonizing Australia. Whatever background you come from always reflects how you sort of see it, and some people like to romanticize it.
Except, of course, without breathable air.
Yeah. Or plants, animals.
That's right. Yeah. Or different gravity and everything else. Yep. Where is the money coming from to fund such an extraordinarily expensive venture?
So I suppose in terms of expense, it's probably a lot less than most people would expect. So it's been priced out at about $6 billion US for the first mission, which sounds like a lot of money initially. And then when you start to think about what the cost of an upgrade on one of our major ovals costs, the cost of a new hospital, that sort of thing, it puts it in perspective.
Donald Trump's presidential campaign.
Yeah, let's not even go near that. But it's all coming from private investment. A lot of companies are seeing this as a way to put their names down in history. For example, if, say, Bill Gates decided to sponsor the entire program, to give the entire $6 billion, there's a really good one. Well, I'm sure that Mars One would call the colony Gatestown. If they would be able to sort of like make that immortal link, it's a way for people and organisations to be involved with something that's bigger than us, something for our species.
What's the timeline, Josh, that they've set themselves? You know, throwing out a timeline into the next couple of decades.
The timelines with space missions are always flexible. Ours is always dictated by how Earth and Mars line up. So every 26 months, about every 2 years or so, we have a launch window where we can send supplies, send probes and things like that. So the first launch that we're looking at is 2020. That's the probe that's essentially going to be landing between 40 degrees and 45 degrees north of the equator and searching for water, searching for a potential site for us to set up the colony. Once that's been identified, we start sending cargo missions in 2022 and 2024. The robotic systems that we'll send with those cargo we'll essentially set that up, build a fully functioning colony with air, with plants, with all that sort of thing for people to arrive in. And the idea is to have that completely set up by April 2026.
Robots will do that.
So robots are all setting all that sort of stuff, and we can do that.
Really?
Yeah.
That's possible?
That's been tested. That's been done before. So I shouldn't say it's been done before, but robots setting things up and building, and that's certainly not beyond the possibility of what we're trying to achieve.
So it's going to be whittled down to four, and you're hoping to be one of those four. Two men, two women?
That's the plan, yeah. It's actually all about representation. So we the species generally drawn along two gender lines, but people from all over. So Mars One's hope is that we'll actually be able to get four people from four different continents as well. So not just sending two men and two women, but also representatives from all the different cultural backgrounds, different continents, from all the people of Earth.
Are they intended to procreate or expected to procreate, or is it just the other way around? Are they? I'm serious. I mean, because it sounds like the Ark in a way.
You always get the Martian baby question.
Yeah. I mean, is that how it works? Are they expected to actually have children, or is they prohibited from
that? From the first crew, the expectation is that you would not. That we don't know how the reduced gravity on Mars is going to affect our reproductive system. So we know from experiments on the space station that rats and flowers and all sorts of other forms of life really struggle to procreate because it doesn't. we don't have gravity as a reference frame. Sort of knowing which way is up and down really affects our reproductive system. We don't know if the 38% gravity on Mars is going to be enough for those reproductive systems to work. So the first crew is not going to be experimenting with babies, but we might take animals to see whether or not they can breed on Mars.
Animals, right. Yeah. So that will be an ark in a way then.
In a little bit, yeah. So probably an ark full of crickets, cockroaches and grasshoppers.
Really?
Yeah,
roaches.
Really. Yeah,
you really want to bring roaches to
Absolutely.
Mars?
Absolutely.
I don't think that's such a good idea, but I'm assuming those guys know best. But the 100 that are there now that you're part of, the Mars 100, how will that be whittled down to two men and two women?
The next stage for us is September this year. Between September 3rd and the 19th, we will be getting together somewhere in the world. They're keeping it a bit of a secret from us at the moment, but we'll get together and essentially be doing group testing. We'll organise ourselves into groups of 10 to 15, see how we work together, how we function across cultural lines, across language barriers, all of that.
Where will you be placed in order to assess this?
In terms of the location?
Yeah, yeah.
This is what I'm saying. They're not telling us yet. It's all being kept a secret.
You have to assume they'll put you in some kind of habitat of a kind.
So that's definitely going to be the second stage. So the first few days is whittling the group down. We're expecting to lose, again, 10 to 15 people per day for the first 3 or 4 days. And after that, they'll put us in a habitat to see how we function.
What do you expect will happen in that period? Will it be like Marine boot camp?
I don't know.
Screaming in your face and seeing if you crack and hit anyone? Because you're going to be put under incredible psychological stress.
Well, the interesting thing with all of this is it's about self-assessment. It's about you reflecting who you are as a person, recognising your strengths and weaknesses. One of my weaknesses, I suppose, is that I do tend to be a little bit of a bull in a china shop at times. If I can see a solution, I just charge ahead and make it happen. And that doesn't always include other people's views. So knowing that about yourself, you can sort of dial it in and try and work with the other people that are there based on the situation.
So, Josh, that first process will whittle away what half the candidates?
Yeah, within the first few days, we will lose half the candidates.
Okay, and then what happens after that?
They're the ones who then go into a habitat. They're the ones who then spend a bit of time for about 9 days or so living inside a habitat, seeing whether or not you're decent housemates. That's kind of what it boils down to. Mars One's looking for 4 MacGyvers that are also good housemates. Like people who can do a little bit of everything, but also get along with others really well. So we'll be testing the housemate side of things in that second stage.
Right, and how many is left at that point?
We whittle it down to 30, and from those 30 people, essentially we do a 4 to 5 hour interview, a psych interview, to see whether or not we have the right sort of mentality for what's involved. We'll lose another 6 people out of that, so narrowing it down to 24, and those 24 start about 10 years worth of training. And during that training, we'll be continuously testing people, seeing whether or not they're appropriate to continue in the program, whether or not they're the high performers, until... In 2026, we've narrowed it down to basically 3 teams of 4, and it'll be one of those teams that goes.
Do you know who the other guys are at this stage?
I know the other 100. I've met a few. So we've got 7 Aussies here in Australia.
7?
All up. There's
right.
7 of us, yeah.
Right.
So I've met a few of them. A big part of my world tour isn't just about performing the show. It's about going to the places where many of these candidates are so I can actually meet them beforehand.
It's a shame they have to come. Well, I was just going to say, what if all 4 are Australians? That's just, I don't know. You say that's not possible. That can't happen. But what if, anyway, I'll put that to one side for the moment. So just say you're selected and you're part of the 4 that's chosen to go a decade and a bit from now, or whenever the timeline is, to travel to Mars. What kind of vessel are they envisaging? What kind of spaceship will you be put in? Do you have any idea?
So it's a disposable spacecraft. So we need essentially something that has decent-sized rocket, a rocket that's sufficient to get us up to the velocities we need.
That's about 3/4 of the job, isn't it, really?
Most of rockets are fuel
and
oxidizer.
Just getting out of the Earth's atmosphere.
Pretty much. So once we can get out of the Earth's atmosphere, we need a second rocket to do that burn from Earth to Mars, or at least start the coast. We need a landing unit that sits on the front, which is very similar to the capsules we'll be living in, but probably a little bit lighter. And then in the middle of that is essentially a school bus size capsule with different living units, with life support systems, all of that. And that's essentially what we call our transit habitat. And that's what we live in for 7 months to get there.
7 months.
Yeah.
Will there be like gym equipment to keep your muscles in tone? Because you lose a bit of muscle tone.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's one of the most vital components for us in terms of slowing down bone density loss, slowing down the muscle loss. We're looking at probably 2.5 to 3 hours of exercise per day, just to try and maintain that. So it's a huge component of our day.
I think one of the weirdest and eeriest and saddest parts of this journey, most melancholic parts of this idea of traveling to Mars, would be if you can look back, you'll see as the ship is going further away from Earth and closer to Mars, the little beautiful blue marble that is the Earth recedes into the distance, and eventually it just becomes another dot of light against the black of space. Are you ready for that thought?
Interestingly enough, that's one of the things that our chief medical selector has actually focused on in particular. His biggest concern out of every stage of launching, of getting to Mars, of living on Mars, isn't the life and death on Mars. There's probably going to be several months during our trip where Earth has disappeared into a tiny little blue dot, and Mars is still a tiny little red dot, and you are literally floating through the darkness of space with no reference frame, no sense of up and down. You're just floating amongst the stars, and that is the biggest part that he's concerned about. And ultimately, you can't test for that. You can't prepare people for that. All you can do is do your best and essentially work to instill a sense of importance, that people recognise that what they're doing is far bigger than themselves and why they're doing this, and that allows them to endure.
You're saying you won't be launching until robot missions have gone ahead to already construct a working habitat, which presumably you'll be able to monitor the success of, and a lot of food dumps before you get there as well.
We'll be there with about 6 years of food, and then we'll start growing our own as soon as we arrive. So there's no shortage of food.
So as soon as you arrive, you'll be able to suit up and walk across to the habitat. Is that the idea?
Essentially, yeah. So we'll land inside a small landing capsule, and then one of the rovers will come and drag the landing capsule towards the colony, so we don't have to get up and try and walk or anything like that.
Well, you'll dock on the colony.
Not necessarily dock, but certainly get as close as possible. After we've spent about 24 hours or so recovering inside the landing capsule, we suit up and climb outside and climb into our new homes.
What's inside that home?
What we're looking at the moment is essentially 6 landing capsules. Very similar. The current designs are very similar to what SpaceX uses with their Dragon. So there's a few different designs that are very similar to sort of current technology. The big area for us is essentially the inflatable habitats that are pushed out the back. So these huge, long, kind of like living inside a submarine, to be honest with you, these big inflatable habitats that will have bedrooms, have servicing areas, have areas for growing crops, all those sort of things. And that we land them compressed, and then over time they expand as we add more and more atmosphere to them.
It's essentially a life indoors, though, isn't it? Really,
very much so. So we've worked out that we can go outside for about 1 hour a day, still suited up, obviously, because the pressure on Mars isn't enough to stop the blood boiling. But we can go outside for about an hour a day, and we won't exceed our radiation limits if we do that.
Oh, okay. So radiation is still...
It's still a huge factor in all of it.
There's less gravity on Mars. There's substantial gravity, but how does it compare to Earth's gravity? Because Mars is smaller than Earth, therefore you'll be lighter, won't you?
So it's about 38%. So I weigh about 65 kilos, and I'll weigh about 23, 24 on Mars.
What does that mean? It means you'd be able to jump up really high.
So there's interesting concerns about being able to jump 3 times higher and all of that, because you're not going to land with more force, but if you twist your ankle or something like that, your bones may have degenerated in the reduced gravity, and you're more prone to spiral fractures and things like that. So
wow, that actually sounds really cool.
It's going to be amazing.
It actually sounds like a lot of fun, having sort of not zero gravity, but gravity. Yeah, air pressure. How does air pressure compare to air pressure on Earth?
Mars's atmosphere is about 200th of what we have here. So we talk about sort of 1,013 millibar being one atmosphere of pressure. Mars has about 6 millibar, so it's a tiny fraction. it essentially works out to about 32 kilometres. If you went 32 kilometres above Earth's surface, that's the amount of atmospheric pressure you'd have on Mars. So it's not a lot. It means that, yeah, if you went outside without a suit on, all the fluids in your body would boil off.
Boil? I've never understood quite what that means for your blood to boil, literally. I mean, literally to boil.
So,
fizzes or what?
It's not just your blood. It's all the fluids in your eyes, in your mouth, all of that. Essentially, all the gases that are stored inside them in solution at normal atmospheric pressure. You reduce that pressure, and all those gases escape from the fluids.
All right, so it does fizz with
literally what? Fizzes.
Oh,
there's only one person, to my knowledge, that's ever experienced it. It was a U.S. Air Force serviceman who was inside a atmosphere chamber, and they were testing a few different things, and he had a fault with his suit. They depressurized the chamber that he was inside of, and he distinctly remembers the sensation of the fluids in his mouth and on his tongue boiling a split second before he passed out. So, yeah, it's pretty scary stuff.
A lot of people like me, I'm sure you have seen The Martian, you know, the Ridley Scott, Matt Damon film.
Yep.
Now, that begins with this really big storm on Mars. And I know Mars does get these gigantic planetary dust storms, but that all seems crap, isn't it?
It is. It is. So Andy Weir, the original author of the novel, has acknowledged multiple times now that he needed Mars to strike first. That's kind of what it boiled down to. He needed some sort of plot device to get the rest of the crew off the surface and with one astronaut left behind.
So why is that? Tell me why that scene then of a gigantic dust storm howling through the habitat and you know, making things fly about. Why can't that happen on Mars?
So you still get 200, 300 kilometre an hour winds on Mars, but it comes down to that tiny atmospheric pressure. So it might be, you might have dust particles flying along at, like I said, 200, 300 kilometres an hour, but they're hitting with the same force of someone throwing a bag of feathers at you. There's no actual force or pressure behind it. It's moving very quickly, but there's very little atmospheric pressure to actually push it. You don't have the bulk of air or atmosphere to actually produce a force.
So it looks terrifying.
Yeah.
And it's operating on a planetary scale, but it just feels like, I don't know, a baby's sigh. Is this why balloon-type rooms are feasible? Because they can't be sort of shredded in
essentially
a gale.
Yeah. We'll also be protecting them as best we can to add to the radiation protection. We'll actually be covering those inflatable habitats over with soil as well. But it's one of the reasons why it works is because that atmospheric pressure makes things easier. Means we don't actually need to pressurize the inside of the habitat to what we breathe here on Earth. We'll be breathing about 65% of the same pressure. So there's not as much atmospheric pressure inside the habitats because it means there's less stress on the habitats as well.
What will you be breathing? Will it be Earth air with majority nitrogen, a bit of oxygen, CO2 thrown in? Or?
There's a few discussions. One of the other options, if we're going to be operating at a lower atmospheric pressure inside the habitat, is rather than using all nitrogen, which is very hard to find on Mars, we might use a bit of argon instead. So that will... that'll change the way our voices sound, like we'll all have deeper voices and things like that.
Oh, it's the opposite of helium then, is it?
It's exactly the opposite of helium. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. But there's a few different options that are being discussed by the folks that are designing the life support systems.
How are they going to make it? How do you make oxygen like that? How do you make breathable air? I don't even know what's in the atmosphere on Mars.
So Mars's atmosphere is about 95% carbon dioxide, which isn't much use to us, but it's great for plants. The way to make oxygen, essentially, is either you can strip it out of the carbon dioxide. The other option is you take all this water that we keep finding on Mars now and you run an electric current through it and it produces oxygen. So,
what do you mean all this water?
Well, this is all the most recent research that's coming out of the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiters and the Mars Global Surveyor, is that we're seeing flowing water on the surface of Mars.
We've seen evidence of it, but I haven't seen water itself, though. Correct me if I'm wrong here, you know much more about this than I do, but I think I've seen evidence of where channels were, but water itself has been seen?
What we're seeing now is what they call recurrent slope lineae, where those channels that you're talking about reappear every summertime. Like each Martian summer, they're changing colours, they're shifting, all that sort of stuff, and we've got very significant evidence that that's water that's been loaded with a particular chemical called perchlorates. So magnesium and calcium perchlorates reduce the freezing point of water to the point where you can actually have flowing water on the surface of Mars.
Wet water.
Wet, that's
on the surface of Mars.
Yep.
And there'll be enough to harvest to sustain this colony?
Well, again, the evidence that we're seeing out of the Curiosity rover is that Mars was originally covered in oceans, and that those oceans haven't disappeared. They've soaked into the soil. They've soaked into the dust. So while we look at a cold, dead, barren, desert-like planet, there's literally oceans of water frozen in underneath.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
I'm with Josh Richards. Josh is currently working as a comedian doing a show called Cosmic Nomad all over the world. He's just finished at the Adelaide Fringe. He's taking it around Australia. Josh also has a background in applied physics and psychology. He's worked as a combat engineer with the Australian and British Armed Forces, and this has given him the kind of background, the rich background, required to become one of the last 100 candidates as part of the Mars One mission. We were speaking there before about water and air. How about food? You can't have an outdoor farm there, can you? So you have to have an indoor farm, right?
Very much so. So what we're looking at the moment, there's a lot of research that's going into all of this in the Netherlands at the moment, is essentially using Martian soil, try and grow things like tomatoes, quinoa, those supposed superfoods, because they're full of nutrients, they're full of all sorts of yeah, and they're hardy. That's the big thing, is that they can survive in these really hostile environments. We do have to grow them inside, and we do need to provide some sort of radiation protection, but growing crops is one of the biggest focuses for us at the moment, is working out how to do that on the surface of Mars.
In the movie The Martian, we see how he makes his own crops by getting his own waste, his human waste, and then, you know, ploughs that into the Martian soil. And that does the trick. I'm sure there's way more to it than that, though, Josh. Is there, or is that as simple as that?
It's, to be honest with you, you need to, like, human waste isn't fantastic.
No.
But people do use human manure, and we will be using it as well. But you do have to process it a little bit, just in terms of making sure that you don't give yourself an infection. So, yeah, there is a little bit more to it, but not much.
Really? So that's all you'll need then? The Martian soil has nutrients in it as well?
That's, again, one of the big questions for us, what those essential elements are. So there are a few things that it's missing. The biggest one that we've noticed so far is there's a distinct lack of nitrogen. So a lot of the plants that we use here really need fertilizers based on nitrogen. So that's probably the biggest challenge for us, finding that particular element.
I'm guessing you have to go vegan while you're there too, just out of sheer.
Yeah,
you
probably
just have to, don't
one
you?
Of the I mean, hardest things for me, to be honest
yeah.
with you. I joke in my show quite regularly that the last thing that I'll do before I leave Earth forever is to eat a slab of bacon.
Right. And then hang on to that memory.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, turns out there's actually a species of Japanese seaweed that if you grow it and fry it, it tastes just like bacon. So you see a problem, we find a solution. But yeah, vegan's definitely going to be a challenge for me.
Bacon, is there anything it can't do? As Homer Simpson said, now even seaweed wants to be bacon.
Exactly.
Of course, that's amazing. That's fabulous. Here's another thing I've thought about. I wonder what it would be like to live in that environment without colour. Everything's so sepia toned. There won't be much in the way of colour.
So you do get blue skies on Mars.
You do?
You do, at sunrise and sunset. Quite regularly, the Curiosity rover in particular has taken quite a few photographs of the Martian sunset, and it's blue because of the way that the light's being scattered. So you do get a little bit of colour, but like you said, those sepia tones, that's a real issue. That's outside. We're going to be spending, 23 hours a day inside.
Dressed like the Wiggles.
And we will not be limiting our colours. It's one of the big discussion points is how you brighten up a room to lighten people up. There's big issues with it in Scandinavian countries where they they colour everything as much as they can to try and avoid seasonal affective disorder. And that's one of the biggest things that we're going to have to face as well.
I've seen some of those lovely pictures from the Mars rovers, and the sun looks different too because it's smaller.
It's further away, yeah.
It's further away. That's kind of a little weird too. It's like a bit the same, but quite a bit different to the surface of the Earth.
So Mars on average is about 220 million kilometres away from the sun. When we talk about those kind of distances, rather than saying 220 million kilometres, we use Earth as a reference. So the average distance that Earth is away from the sun is called one astronomical unit. Mars usually sits at about 1.5. So it's half the distance, again, away from the sun.
So temperature will need to be regulated very heavily. It'll get very, very hot at some points and very, very, very cold at other times.
Well, yeah, this is one of the interesting challenges, is that space is, you know, on average about minus 270 degrees. But one of the biggest issues for astronauts doing spacewalks in space is overheating, because there's no way for that heat to radiate, the heat that your body creates. There's nowhere for it to be radiated away into. And we'll have a similar problem on Mars, where the soil will carry the heat away, but there's no atmosphere to carry heat away. So we'll actually have to try and keep ourselves cool, even though it's minus 56 degrees on average.
Four people are going, two men, two women from different parts of the world. How will government work there?
This is definitely something that's being left up to us. So while Mars One will select 24 people, they want to find 24 people who get along. They don't care how they get along. So if there's four folks who they have a highly regimented military structure with rules and how everything works and it's all laid out, and they don't work as efficiently as four anarchist slackers who can fix everything but don't have any rhyme or reason to how they do it, and that those four anarchists work more efficiently than the four military ones, they'll send the four anarchists. It's all about finding the systems that work best and not applying any specific value or any specific ideology to it beforehand.
Because I can't help but notice you can have a 2-2 vote, can't you, when there's four.
And that's one of the biggest challenges. That's why they're locking us up for, you know, inside habitats to train for nigh on 10 years, is to work out how we solve problems rather than telling us how to do it.
Vehicles. Lost in Space had a chariot. Will you have a chariot?
I don't think I will have a chariot.
Well,
but I think maybe crew 3 or 4 might. So they might have some sort of rover that's able to explore further. What a lot of people don't realise, particularly with the first crew, we're going to be taking 7 months to get there. We'll be waiting for another 26 months before the second crew arrives. So we're living there for, you know, nigh on 3 years by ourselves. We're not going to be going anywhere.
Oh, there's more crews coming.
So every right. 26 months afterwards, we send another crew. And they take about 7 months to get there as well. So
another four people?
Another four people. And they generally, we're expecting them to be selected out of that astronaut corps of 24 that Mars One's training on Earth. Those people will be picked every 2 years or so.
And the base will get bigger and bigger to accommodate them as you go?
Yeah, exactly. So about 3 or 4 weeks after the first crew arrives, the supplies for the second crew arrives after that. So we might land with about 6 years of worth of food, but a couple of weeks later, another 6 years worth of food arrives. So if there is some problem in the intervening 2 years, we have heaps of food, we have heaps of spare parts, we can wait it out for another 2 years before whatever problem has been fixed.
I'm really into the whole idea of humans going to Mars. So don't get me wrong when I ask this question. When I was watching The Martian, I'm thrilled to bits that Matt – spoiler alert here, by the way, spoiler alert about The Martian. I'm thrilled to bits that Matt Damon gets rescued at the end. But the thought occurred to me, and it's never addressed in the film, is what about all that crap he left behind? Yeah. What about all the junk, the rubbish he left behind on the surface of Mars, of his half-ruined habitat and all the other stuff? It's just like all the crap that's circling in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. We humans, we leave junk behind. Wherever we go, we don't, you know, clean up after ourselves.
I think in order to get things to Mars, the extreme cost that's involved with that, it doesn't make sense for us to leave things behind. It doesn't make sense for us to not recycle. One of the biggest focuses with Mars One is about designing life support systems where we can recycle everything. So a lot of the systems we're using are being designed around the idea of using 3D printed parts. So rather than trying to take spare parts, if something breaks, we print out a new part. We can then take the old part and melt it down and reuse that resource to be able to just keep replacing things.
Is there a kind of an ethics of that? I mean, will you need to bury your junk? I mean, bury your stuff that you don't use?
At the moment, because I was lucky enough to actually work on the summary for the life support system for Mars One, and the only byproduct that we produce from the system that keeps us alive, that deals with all our waste, that produces, like, provides us with water for showers and things like that, the only thing that gets left behind is essentially it's essential oils. So the same thing that they advertise for skin creams and things like that, so, you know, seven essential oils or whatever it is, that's the waste product that we end up being left behind, because that's something that our body produces that the systems that we have won't be able to process.
Josh, it's still not clear whether there's microbial life still on Mars. There probably was in the past, maybe. We don't really know, do we? Are there some concerns that if we set up a human colony there, that humans will interact with that, ruin it, do something to, I don't know, spoil the emergence of native indigenous life on Mars?
There's huge concerns about this sort of stuff, and luckily enough, the United Nations actually has been set up for decades to deal with it. They have a panel called COSPA, which is all about planetary protection and preventing contamination between Earth and other bodies in the universe. So it's not just about protecting Mars from Earth, it's actually about protecting Earth from Mars as well. You know, if astronauts went to Mars, like NASA's talking about in the late 2030s, sending crews to Mars and then bringing them back again, if they were to do that, how do you decontaminate your astronauts to make sure they're not bringing back some bug that's been sitting in Martian dirt for the last million years and spreads like wildfire here on Earth? So there's all these laws and legislations, what we call soft laws, trying to guide how different space agencies operate on other planets. It's challenging. It's really challenging. The best way that we can circumvent all of that is to land in an area that's not likely to have life. So Mars One's looking at landing in an area of 40 to 45 degrees north of the Martian equator. It's essentially the equivalent of the Sahara Desert on Mars. It's wide open plains. There's not very much out there. We will land out there trying to land in an area that's got water, but it's not going to have life. There's next to no expectation that we would find life somewhere like that. But we could then land rovers in some of the areas that might have life. And rather than trying to control those rovers from here on Earth, we could control them from people on the surface of Mars. Because at the moment, if you try and talk between Earth and Mars, there's anywhere between a 4 and 26 minute delay. Whereas if you're controlling that robot from the surface of Mars, there'd be next to no delay. So you'd be able to control it and explore and look for life more effectively by having people in an area that's safe, that won't contaminate it, and use robots to explore the area trying to find microbial life.
Why would we want to even do this? Why would we even want to have a colony on Mars?
I see it as a chance for us to embrace who we are as a species, as explorers, a way for a generation of kids to grow up where someone takes them out into a park, points out a little red dot in the sky and tells them that people live up there. It's about us being able to find out more about who we are as a species, where we came from. There's a very real possibility that billions of years ago life started on Mars, and through asteroid impacts, rocks carrying some of that microbial life migrated to Earth. So we may in fact be Martians. So you're never truly going to know whether or not that's the case until you send people to Mars to go and explore it ourselves. Robots are great, but they're not particularly versatile and they're not that fantastic at science. We know that the Curiosity rover, its 2-year initial mission probably could have been done by a human in about 3 days.
Worst case scenario stuff. What kind of scenarios are being contemplated?
Explode on the launch pad, explode on the way, explode on impact. It's interesting talking to people about this generally. The questions that they ask and the fears that they have always reflects their own background. I propose the idea of going one way to Mars, and it's interesting seeing where people come from with it. Some people worry about withering away and dying slowly underground, living on Mars in 20, 30 years' time. Some people worry about, you know, the rocket launch. Some people worry about the radiation poisoning. It always reflects the fears of the questioner.
That's really interesting, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, of course, that tells you what it means to be human, the whole idea of what anxieties you would have about going and living on Mars for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's I think I see it as an opportunity. I don't stress too much about the things that could go wrong. I look at what could go wrong and I work out how to solve those problems. But I'm a big believer of turning things into opportunities rather than seeing them as obstacles to get over, seeing them as a way to bounce off whatever this particular thing is and seeing it as another opportunity. The example I use quite regularly is those perchlorates we talked about before that we found in the water. If you were to inhale Martian dust loaded with perchlorates, it actually shuts down your thyroid and has massive effects on thyroid glands. So there's a huge health hazard there. But perchlorates can also be used as an oxidizer for rocket fuel. So while some people might sort of say, oh, you know, it's impossible to go to Mars because, you know, you take one breath of the Martian dust and it's going to kill you, and other people look at it and go, that's amazing, we could use that particular chemical to possibly send samples of soil back to Mars. Maybe we'd find a way to be able to launch off the surface of Mars and go and explore the asteroid belt. There's more opportunities. So that's my focus. I suppose the big question I have for most folks is, what if we don't go? What if we don't try? If we just stay here on Earth, if, you know, a couple of million years ago we just decided to stay in the cave instead, what would have happened then? So again, it's a shift of perspective. It's rather than stressing about the things that could go wrong, you look at what could go wrong and you try and find ways to overcome it.
When you found out about Mars One's astronaut call out, how long did you think about it before you applied?
I remember I was researching the show, sitting in a little cafe in Brighton in the UK, and I'd typed in Mars One Way into Google, and this thing had popped up, and I read the press release, and I sort of went, right, well, I guess the show's going to change then, because the show shifted from being, why haven't we done this as a species? We could have done it 2 decades ago. You know, basically humanity sucks for not doing it, and me turning around and going, well, I have to put my money where my mouth is. Like, if someone's offering me the opportunity to go one way to Mars, I can't complain that no one's done it yet if I don't put my hand up to do it. So it was probably about a 5 to 10 minute process.
That's it? That's all? Really?
It's been ongoing ever since. Like, you question it every single day. You right. wake up and you question what you're doing and whether or not you're the right person for it and all of that.
Because, Josh, Earth is beautiful.
Earth is beautiful.
Earth's gorgeous.
And I think the best...
You're not going to have beaches where you're going if you're going to go to Mars.
Well, I think the best way for us to appreciate this planet is by seeing it from above. There's so many astronauts who go into orbit, they see Earth, and they come back as ardent environmentalists. It changes their perspective. It's a psychological effect called the overview effect. It genuinely changes the way people see our planet. And yeah. for me, by, again, having a generation of kids grow up where they can watch people living on Mars, it makes them realize that they are living on a planet rather than just, you know, oh, whatever patch of dirt you happen to be born on or where you grew up.
Have you met other astronauts? Well, other, you're not an astronaut yet, but have you met astronauts, people who have actually been into space?
Yeah, I've met quite a few now. I've been involved with the International Space University. They run a Southern Hemisphere program here in Adelaide every year, and I was a student on one 2 years ago, and I've just finished being a teaching associate just recently.
And what do they think, these astronauts, of this plan?
It varies considerably. So without naming names, there's one astronaut that I met a couple of years ago who is virulent in his disgust at the program.
Why? Because you're not returning?
His big thing is that it's not returning, that we don't have the technology to go to Mars yet, that we'll all die within a few months because of radiation poisoning, because of a whole raft of different things. We tried to have a civil discussion, and I think we both gave up in the end. But at the same time, I met another astronaut on the same course who considered applying himself. He's a currently serving astronaut with the European Space Agency. And he discussed the concept of wanting to put his hand up to do it himself. So it varies considerably.
There's always the case, in such things when you're going to do an insane but amazing thing like this, or maybe going to do this, I should say. How do you tell mum? How did your mum find out?
You tell mum probably better than the way that I did. I found out about Mars One on a Thursday, and I started making preparations to sort of make it all happen on the Friday. I wrote a post on my website for the Saturday, and it was scheduled to go out on the Monday. And I always had a phone call with mum on a Sunday. Like, that was our weekly phone call. And for whatever reason, I missed the call. And the post went out automatically on my website on the Monday morning.
And what did she say to you?
She was mortified, to be honest with you. She, yeah, she basically sort of said, "What is this? What have you signed up for?" She didn't say, "Don't you love us anymore?" But that was basically the insinuation behind it. So, yeah, it was very challenging for mum to face.
And what did you say to her?
I suppose I just remember apologising profusely. I just got wrapped up in the amazing synchronicity of it all, that I was determined to write a comedy show about something, and then suddenly I had the opportunity to do it. I just got swept up in it. We didn't stress that we'd missed the phone call. It happened occasionally. It wasn't anything out of the blue, but it was one phone call that I should not have missed. So mum was mortified at the time, but she's now probably my biggest supporter.
Really? She's okay on the idea?
I don't think she's okay on the idea. I think she understands that it's what gets me out of bed in the morning. She helps organise me visit schools. She sees that passion in my eyes, that this is something that's really important and it's bigger than us. It's bigger than me as a person. It's bigger than my immediate family. It's about doing something that's pretty extraordinary.
I hope this isn't too much of a personal question, but how hard is it to sustain a relationship with another person?
Very.
I'm actually going to leave this planet if everything goes right.
It is very, very difficult. It doesn't stop me, foolishly, but it's certainly been very challenging on previous partners. And I had a partner in the UK when I found out about this, and had to essentially say to her, "I need to go back to Australia. I can promote the colonisation of Mars better by being an Australian candidate that's living in Australia talking to the Australian media than I could staying in the UK." So I had to let that go. I still stay in touch with her. I'm going to be seeing her in a couple of months when I'm back in the UK. But that's the nature of the beast.
Here's a final worst-case scenario, I think, for you. It doesn't happen. Either Mars One fails to eventuate because, you know, let's face it, they're still looking for money. It's kind of an insane idea in a lot of ways, like the moon landings were. Yep. Sure. Not inconceivable, though. And or you miss out or something. And you're setting your whole life directing towards this goal now, where it's hard to keep relationships going and do all these other things. What then? Are you ready for that?
I suppose the big thing for me, I look at all of this and I see it as amazing opportunities. I've literally spent the last 3 years going and speaking to kids in schools about space exploration. I cannot think of many things that are cooler than that. If someone had come and visited me when I was 10 or 12 and talked about missions to Mars, it would have changed my entire career path. You talked about all the weird and wonderful things that I did. That essentially boils down to the fact that no one ever told me I could work in space when I was a little. I was told that it was impossible because of my nationality, because I wasn't a US citizen. And so I had to let go of that, and I tried all these other weird and wonderful things. And now someone has finally turned around and said, "Yes, you can do this." And as I've gotten more and more involved with Mars One, I've discovered that there are extraordinary opportunities to work in the space industry. They're just very well hidden from Australians.
What kind of questions do kids ask you when you tour around? They'd be actually pretty high-quality questions.
They're extraordinary questions, and it's fantastic that they don't have the same filters that adults do. So the best question I've had to date was a little six-year-old girl asking me, if someone died on Mars, would I eat them? Which is
wow, that's a good question. And would you?
Well, you try and introduce a few steps in between eating them.
How bad things would have to get.
Yeah. But the idea would be a human body is full of elements, it's full of nutrients, all sorts of things. So if you could process someone into fertilizer to feed the plants, then, you know, you wouldn't want to waste all the nutrients that a human body has inside of it just by burning it or burying it. So a little bit challenging for some people to wrap their head around, but it's about utilizing the resources that you have around you, and it'd be a massive waste to just throw a body out onto the surface.
Best case scenario, it all works. You go, it actually works pretty well. You're spending all this time on Mars with actually what would have to be a very interesting group of people and creative group of people. And you live to a certain age and then you die. And then you're buried on Mars, cremated on Mars.
Well, there's the question. You wouldn't necessarily want to set fire to someone's body inside a spacecraft. Fires inside spaceships is not fun.
That's good. No.
But burying's not really an option either, primarily because of the contamination issue we were talking about before. Human bodies are covered in bugs and all sorts of weird and wonderful things. And if you were to put a body out on the surface of Mars or even bury it, you'd still be releasing all those pathogens, all those germs and all the bacteria into the Martian soil.
So what do you do with a dead body on Mars?
Well, yeah, again, you can either turn a person into fertilizer, so feed them back into the
gardens.
Or if you're dead set about being buried on the surface of Mars, you can actually seal someone's body up in a hermetically sealed bag, and that would keep everything inside.
One final question. There's a thing, an idea that has been raised for quite a while now by science fiction writers, which is the idea of terraforming other planets, and Mars would have to be the very first candidate if and when the technology might become available to humans. The process whereby some massive engines are put on the surface of a planet like Mars, the air becomes like Earth's air, the same air pressure, it becomes more and more Earth-like due to technologies that aren't available to us right now. Would that be an ultimate goal, or would you rather see Mars be left pristine as it is?
It's interesting. There's talk about, there's an old Kim Stanley Robertson novel series called Red, Green and Blue Mars, talking about the colonization of Mars and terraforming and all that sort of thing. And they split people into two camps of like reds and greens, where greens want to change Mars to be more Earth-like so that we can walk around without suits on and things like that. And then there's reds. And the reds are made fun of a little bit in the book. They're kind of treated as these sort of backward-thinking type people. I'd much prefer to keep the planet pristine. We'd destroy any evidence of life on Mars if we were to try and terraform. We started messing with the environment. Mars is the way that it is because nature's put it that way. It's turned out to be a cold, dead planet. I would much prefer to explore and keep it pristine as best we can rather than trying to make Mars Earth-like. I know that's not a popular thing amongst science fiction type people, but we've seen a precedent in Antarctica where we try and keep Antarctica as best we can, clean without contaminating it, taking everything away from it, recycling as best we can. I'd love to see Mars treated the same way.
If you can have a situation where you have a Mars colony and a return flight, would you ever want to take that return flight?
No. And strangely enough, this is the final question we got in our psych interview too. If you answered yes to this, you're no longer with the program. So they're looking for people who don't just want to explore. They want to help colonize another planet. They want us to become a dual planet species. So it's not good enough to just go and explore and spend some time there for, you know, maybe a couple of years and then come back again. It's about us expanding where humans are in the universe. It's about not taking a backward step and coming back to Earth. I'd like to go further. I'd like to go onto Mars, and if there was an opportunity to, say, go and explore the moons of Jupiter or go beyond, why would you turn that down?
Because crushing gravity will squish you into a grape. That's why.
But you'd learn more about the universe in the process.
That's right, before that last moment. That's a whole other conversation. Great to speak with you, Josh. And who knows, maybe 20 years from now we'll have a conversation, me here on Earth, you on Mars, and we'll just have to somehow deal with the awkwardness between the, 7 to 20 minute delay, I think you said.
We'll work it out.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.